From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on Mother's Day, 1973. Former men's tennis star Bobby Riggs had boasted that even at age 55, he could beat the top women's players in the world. He had challenged the great Billie Jean King, who declined. But on that Mother's Day, he took on Margaret Court in a match played in California before a television audience and 5,000 fans. Much to the dismay of many of the fans, Riggs won easily, 6-2, 6-1. And Billie Jean King would later say that she knew when she got the news that Bobby won, she was going to have to play him, and she would have to win. That set up the match in September of 1973 that is known as the Battle of the Sexes, Riggs versus King, at the Astrodome in Houston, Texas. 30,000 in attendance in the stadium, 90 million watching around the world. There was pageantry, little humor, but deep down, Riggs and King both badly wanted to win. And by now, you probably know the historic result. Billie Jean King dominated the match, winning all three sets, humbling Bobby Riggs, and striking a blow for women's tennis. That year, 1973, King had threatened to boycott the U.S. Open if the women didn't get paid the same as the men. The U.S. Open complied, but it took another 28 years before any of the other Grand Slam tournaments did the same. And it wasn't until 2007 that Wimbledon paid the women as much as the men, even though the modern women's game is often better rated and more compelling than the men's. Well, Billie Jean King is coming to Rochester, the headliner, for the annual Susan B. Anthony birthday luncheon. But first, she's our guest for the half hour here on Connections. She's on the line with us, and Billie Jean, it is my honor to have you. How are you?
Oh, it's great. Thank you so much, Evan. I'm really looking forward to coming to Rochester and being a part of their celebration of Susan B. Anthony's birthday, and they do it every year, so I'm looking really forward to it because she's one of my sheroes, Susan B. Anthony, and, you know, we all owe her a lot, so it's going to be a privilege and an honor to be there.
Well, there are still tickets available, and Deb Hughes is the president and CEO of the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. She's in studio with me, and, you know, you're kind of joking before the hour, but there are tickets, but probably not for long. Nope. How do they get tickets?
We decided to keep it open till after the show. They can get tickets online on our webpage.
And what's the webpage?
The webpage is SusanBAnthonyHouse.org.
SusanBAnthonyHouse.org. This is quite a bit. I mean, you guys always have great speakers, but this is a big get for you, Deb.
You know, Billie Jean, it's really great to be almost in a room with you. I love the way our communication director phrased it on our social media. She said, "It's one great human rights icon honoring another." And
well,
I can't think of...
I'm in great company with Susan B. Anthony, so that's... Oh, wow. Thank you.
Yeah, that's how we feel about it, too. Pretty excited.
Well, so you can get tickets now, and as we said, they're likely to go. The event is on February 10th, starting at noon at the Rochester Riverside Convention Center. Tickets at SusanBAnthonyHouse.org. Now, Billie Jean King, you've said that you knew you wanted to be the best tennis player in the world by the time you were 11 or 12. You also started thinking about women's equality. I mean, do you remember the first time you actively thought about, for example, pay disparity? I mean, was it that early? Was it later?
I probably started to really notice it when I played tennis, because when it's yourself working and playing and performing, but we all were in the same boat in the beginning, the men and the women, basically making $14 a day as amateurs. And then I really fought for pro tennis. But as a child, at 11, I wanted to be number one. And then at 12, I did have my epiphany where I thought about our sport. You know, it's white shoes, white clothes, white balls, and everybody who played is white. And I remember asking the question, you know, where is everybody else? And that really set my goals. And I decided there, I thought way beyond tennis, so I started thinking about the world. And I said to myself, I'm going to spend the rest of my life fighting for equal rights and opportunities for boys and girls, men and women. And I always included men in my thinking. I always have. People tend to label a woman as somebody who just thinks about women. And that's not really that's not my true self, my authentic self. But I've been labeled that forever. But if you look at my history and what I've done, you would know I do team tennis, which is a pro league. And we have we're into our 41st season in the summer. It's city versus city, but we have equality on each team. We're the only pro league, I think, ever in the history where we have equality on our team in every way. So, like, we have two men and two women minimally, and then we have both genders contribute to the team score equally, because the way we do the events, we do men's and women's singles, men's and women's doubles, and mixed, so you have equality on the court as well. You have the men and the women on the court at the same amount. And that, to me, sends the socialization process that goes on with children is when they see things that you can see it to be at number one. And number two, they don't realize it, but they're seeing a cooperative effort between both genders. Of course, now we have to say all genders because people self-identify differently. But we also had Dr. Renee Richards play back in 77. She's a transgender, and she's my ophthalmologist. So we're just very much on inclusion, children see us cooperating, and they see where sometimes the women are the stars or the leaders, and then other times you see supportive roles, and it goes back and forth during the match. I mean, if you have women's doubles on the court and the men are sitting on the bench supporting the women, and then when they're up, the women are supporting them, and then during mixed doubles you have men and women sitting on the bench supporting whoever's out there. See, the children are seeing this, and they're seeing that cooperative effort. They're seeing the leadership and the supportive roles at the same time, and they're going to think it's normal for men and women to be working together equally, and that sometimes the woman's going to be the boss. But and also the bonus money and all that is all equal, which we think is very important. And we have an MVP male and female and a rookie of the year male and female. So everyone is a part of it. I'm very big on inclusion. I don't like to leave anybody out. I never did. So even as a child, my brother is the same way. And my younger brother, Randy Moffitt, you know, has played Major League Baseball. He played Major League Baseball, most of it in the 70s, for 12 years. Most of those years with the San Francisco Giants as a relief pitcher. But he and I always protected the kids. We're kind of like, we didn't like discrimination or bullying ever. And we were kind of the two kids in the neighborhood that protected all the other kids. You know, I never chose the worst kid on a team last. We never would do that. When we chose teams, we made sure that they were never chosen last. You know, like they're always chosen last, a lot of kids, and that does not send a good message or a positive message to them. Just because you're not good in one thing doesn't mean you're not great in another. So Randy and I are very protective, and it must be from my parents.
Yeah,
sure.
You know, it's heavy stuff to start thinking about before you're even a teenager, and then carrying it throughout your life as you have. We're talking to Billie Jean King, and
well, I don't know. I'm always very serious, but I like to laugh a lot. But I am very serious.
Well, and you know, see, look, that's a great segue. That I promise you, we're not going to spend the next 20 minutes on the Riggs match, because everywhere you go, people probably, even though there was only 30,000 there and 90 million watching. I think probably 90 million people have told you they were there. My guess is when they meet you.
Actually, a lot of people have. You're right. I go, wow, maybe we had 100,000. Sure. Yes. Seems like it.
Yeah, but I will say, you know, I was born a little bit after that match, just to date myself. But when I was growing up, you know, hearing about it, I heard, alternatively, I would hear Billie Jean. I would hear a great, important moment, a hard-fought match, great victory for Billie Jean. And others would say, well, you know, it was an exhibition. He wasn't going that hard. I'm pretty sure that the rules were different for the two.
People have to think about Bobby when they say that.
Yeah.
Bobby had it all teed up, okay, with Jerry Parenteau, the promoter. If he won that match, he had the whole game plan of how they were going to capitalize on it. From jobs, speeches, also another, he was going to set up other matches to continue the idea, because there's great money in it. And people don't understand that was a resurrection for him, because, you know, he was a former number one player, but he during his career, the highlight of his career was during the Second World War and just after the Second World War. So he was basically deprived of getting the attention that he deserved back in the 40s. And so this was amazing for him, and he loved the attention. He was a former number one player. He was finally, you know, his name was finally known, and everybody thought he was a hack. A lot of people didn't realize his history. But because I love history, and the more you know about history, the more you know about yourself, he was one of my heroes. So I already knew about him, and I already knew that he won a triple crown at Wimbledon. And his mixed doubles partner was Alice Marble, who actually helped me as a 15-year-old. And I used to go and see her every weekend, and she taught me. So I had many connections to him, and I knew about him, and I'd always heard stories about him because we both grew up in Southern California. So people would always tell me about him and that he was always hustling. Now he'd be going to Gamblers Anonymous and trying probably not to, but in those days everybody thought it was cute and fun. I mean, that's how they looked at gambling in those days. So we know a little bit better that, you know, it's not a good thing to be addicted like that.
Sure,
know,
but he was invested in that match heavily. I mean,
absolutely, because he had his whole life plan. And if he beat me, do you realize the continuation he would have had to continue this this attention that he had? And he was a chauvinist, but he was an honest chauvinist. I mean, I've been around a lot of guys who say they're not and they are. I really enjoy the ones who say they are, and at least we're both honest and we know where we stand and we can have fun with it. But and then eventually I hope they shift thinking and over time. But if you just keep pounding on people, it's a tightrope trying to get people to change their hearts and minds. It's a tightrope as a woman, I can tell you. My whole life has been like being on a tightrope, trying to figure out how not to be too strident, but get the point across, but have some fun, and let them go away and reflect. And it is very difficult, because with Title IX in 72, I was trying to change the hearts and minds of people with that match, to match up with that legislation. You can have all the legislation you want, but if the hearts and minds don't match up with it, usually things don't really go as well. Because there was already people against Title IX as soon as it was passed. And I knew that, and I was afraid that we'd go backwards. Because you have to understand there were quotas before 1972 in the classroom. And so we wanted women, like a lot of times, even at Harvard, were at 5% in the classroom. So this is just not right. So, and now we have, 56, 57% of women in colleges and universities. Now the men, we've got to worry about them. They should be at least 50% or 49-point-something percent in colleges and universities. And they're not. And we know that getting through college or university now is like used to be high school or 2 years at college. You really have to have that minimally. And mostly Hispanic and African-American boys are not getting through college. Sometimes they start, but they don't finish. And the colleges and universities, what they're doing is getting a lot of counselors and adding on counseling, because they're finding without that support system, the kids flounder and they don't know how to finish and graduate. And a lot of times they're working. The family wants them to quit school, to go to work, to bring in money to the family. So they have a lot of pressures that other children that are wealthier have come, you know, they're second, third, fourth generation Americans. They're not first generation. It makes a huge difference in their lives if they can have the support system.
And so Billie Jean had all this pressure in 1973 in a match that was absolutely a hard-fought match. She dominates the match. And Billie Jean, I'm curious then, after that happened, there were a couple of people that I want to know if they ever came back to you and apologized. First of all, you said you wouldn't do the match if certain announcers were on it. There were certain announcers who didn't think you even deserved a place on the court with a man, which was sad enough. And I wonder if anybody in the announcing circle, if anybody ever came to you later and said, I was wrong. And did Bobby Riggs, I mean, I know you knew him decently well. Did he
I knew him. I knew him all the way through the rest of his life.
Did he come to you and say, you know, I know I was a chauvinist and some of it was for theater, but my views have changed.
No, he didn't have to, because he and I got along well. I mean, but obviously during the match, you're trying to beat each other's brains out. I mean, that's sports.
But did he moderate?
Great athletes go out and kill each other and then go to dinner after. He really felt that women should not be working. And I mean, he was a little theatrical with the barefoot and pregnant thing, you know. But still, he never got such attention from women as he had during that time. Hmm. So he loved it, he and I are really good friends, and I kept trying to explain to him that this was about history and about all these things, and he didn't understand until right before his death. And the last phone call we had, and I wanted to go see him, he wouldn't let me see him. He said, we really made a difference, didn't we? And I said, I exhaled and went, he got it. Finally, he got it. He was near the end of his life, his few last breaths of his life, but he got it. Because that's what I was trying to explain to him before the match happened. Bobby, this is not about money. This is not about attention. Well, the attention's good, the exposure, because we're sending a message. And I said, you know, it's about history. This is about change. This is about history. I was trying to explain to him sweetly, and he just looked at me like, eh, you know, what, 100,000 take one or take all, you know, and all that. And I'm like, okay, whatever. But he got it at the end of his life. But change takes time.
Billie Jean King, my guest. She's coming to Rochester Wednesday, February 10th. For the noon Susan B. Anthony birthday luncheon at the Rochester Riverside Convention Center. Tickets are still available, susanbanthonyhouse.org. Now, many people over the years have told you what that match meant to them. And my understanding is even President Obama has said, even though he was a young man at the time, that match influenced him at the time, and it would eventually influence the way he thinks about equality for his own daughters. What did he tell you?
Well, the first time I got a one-on-one in the White House with him, of course, you can imagine, I was like, ugh. I couldn't even sit in the chair next to where you usually sit for the photos. I sit over on the sofa, and he looked at me like, huh? I said, huh. Of course, the photos don't come out as well, so you have to stand in front of the desk, get a decent photo. But he did explain to me. In fact, he said it did influence him, because he was 12 years old when he watched the match. I think he was born in 61. And I find that many men that come up to me were at that age, 12 to about 18, and it's very impressionable age, and they're the ones that cry more than the women when they come up to me. They get tears in their eyes because now they have a child or children, and they always say, I think I know I'm raising my daughter differently because of that match, and I want her to have as much as my son. And I think, you know what, bingo. And then the women, on the other hand, come up, and they say it really gave them confidence, self-esteem, empowered them. They asked for a raise for the first time. And I said, more importantly, did you get it? And they said, yes, we did. You know, I did. And that's what I know each the different genders, what they got out of it is very interesting and their perceptions. But I find that the men come up to me and definitely started as a, because they're so impressionable at that age, they said that it changed their whole life and how they thought about women and how they should be treated, about equal pay, and all these things, and how slow it's been. They can't believe it's still not happening, because when I played Bobby, white women were making 59 cents on the dollar, and now we're up to about 88, and the women of color still are making way, way less. I think the women of color, probably Deborah knows this better than I do. I'll look it up before I come and see you guys, but I think it's like 64%. And then Hispanics are less, or maybe that's what Hispanics are. And but anyway, women of color make a lot less, and that, it's got to stop. And within 1 year, a woman's is making less than a male usually with 1 year at work. If they, let's say they start out evenly, which they usually don't, because girls don't negotiate their first job, and therefore at the end of their lives they make $500,000 less than their cohort, the men. So they have to. They don't realize you have to negotiate your first job. That helps you get started right. They're not used to negotiating. A woman's just thrilled she has a job and says, thank you so much.
Well, and I got to jump in, and I want to ask you this, because every time, Billie Jean, every time we talk about the pay gap between men and women on this program, someone calls me to tell me that the real reason women get paid less, even for the same work, which they do, mm-hmm. is that men advocate for raises and promotions more aggressively, and women should either do the same or stop complaining.
You know, I think it's a good
I hear
point.
That every time.
I think it's a good point. I think it's a very good point, because what girls don't grow up in the same culture as boys. That's why I want girls to be in sports. If you play sports, you actually learn the culture that was set up by men many centuries ago. And you have to understand it, I think, because you know how to navigate it. You learn from them how the business world works and how it, the culture of it. And the women do have to do this, but what happens with companies is that, and the Wall Street Journal did a survey and did a study on this, is that women are hired on their results, and they're promoted on their results, and men are hired on potential. So the men that are saying we should not bellyache, they're right in one way, but they're not right in another. They also have to understand the culture and the power of the culture, the people at the top, and how they think. And they will give a guy an opportunity because they think, oh, he's really got potential. And they never or hardly ever do that with women. They only do it on our results. And it's really exhausting. I'll tell you a perfect example. Back in the 70s when we had our women's professional tour for the first time, It was very difficult. You're trying to get started. You have no infrastructure. You have to get sponsors. You have to do all this. Okay? So the Denver people called us and said, oh, we're interested in having a tournament here, but we're not sure you guys can even sell a ticket. So we're going to do an exhibition. Would you and Rosie Casals come in and do an exhibition to see if we think we can support it? Now, that kind of thinking never even crosses their mind with the men, ever. They think, of course the men will draw here. Yeah, we're going to have it. First of all, it's usually the old boy network. They know somebody that knows somebody. So they set it up. The men never, that I've ever heard, I've never heard that, oh, you have to come and do an exhibition to prove that you're deserving of this opportunity. And that's why, as a woman going through the world, and I'm a white woman, I'm one of the lucky ones, it's absolutely, the journey is exhausting, because this is constantly in our heads. And I see it every day. I feel it every day. I hear it every day. And now remember, I'm the lucky one, and I'm exhausted. Can you imagine what a woman of color is going through, or a woman in poverty, or low-income women? It is, and also 40% of working mothers are the sole breadwinners. So when you don't get as much money, and these are people having babies, you're not helping the young children being born into this world today if they're not making as much as the male. They're hurting the families. If you get equal pay for women, you are taking care of everybody, families, boys, girls, everybody, husbands, spouses, whatever. People have not figured that out yet. We get the women's pay up, we get rid of poverty, the children are taken better care of, they have a better chance to get an education, being better fed, and being loved. It's just being able, when people are happier, they can give more love, they can be more warm. It just creates a culture, a home culture, that is just so much more productive and loving and warm. And people don't understand that. So it's important that women get as much. And in fact, I'm probably going to the White House tomorrow for the Lily Ledbetter Day or whatever. So it's. I don't think people think of it. I don't think they think of the ramifications enough to their families.
Well, before I let you go here, I want to ask you one more question that I hadn't originally planned to ask, but last hour on this program we talked about what gender policing is, a sort of a separate issue. But one of our callers raised the question on the way the sports world treats Serena Williams, one of the finest tennis players who's ever lived, and raised the idea that, boy, she can't even play a tournament without getting criticized that she's too masculine. She's too
or her
this.
Her body image.
Yeah, she's too this or she's too that.
Well, I know. That's what we have to deal with. Or you're not feminine enough, you're not this enough, you're too much that. And also people are racist. Women of color have different body types than some other women, and what they think is the ideal body type. If you're a black, in the African-American community, I've asked men and women in the African-American beauty community, they think that Serena Williams got the greatest body, okay? You ask white people, and they go, oh, no, you know, she's too much this, too much that, or whatever, too muscular, or her backside's too big, or something. And see, that's the difference in cultures. She's totally honored, and I think we need to stop this stereotyping of body image and talk about her. Even with Hillary Clinton, I read an article the other day. Oh, now we don't talk about Hillary's clothes anymore and her hair. Well, you just did. You know, it's like, are you kidding? And there was no byline, so I don't know who wrote it. It's like, it's just amazing when I hear this. And, of course, I am going all over the country. Well, I'm not all over, but New Hampshire. And I've been in New Hampshire and Iowa for Hillary, but I am prejudiced, absolutely. So she's the one that cares about families. She's the one that cares about people and families, equal pay for women, because she knows how it affects the families and bring back the middle class. That's what we need. We need help, and we need somebody can, you know, navigate the government, knowing what it's like. Oh my God, it's so complex today. When I go to the White House and just walk through and listen to people, it is so complex. Oh my God, you got to really know how it works. Right down to the nth degree, and I don't know how they do it.
Well, we'll see what comes out of the presidential race. You're coming to Rochester Wednesday, February 10th. Billie Jean King, What's the message you'll be sharing here? What's sort of a preview, Billie Jean?
Well, I think I'm a fan of history. I'm a fan of Susan B. Anthony. And I think that I will be talking to the crowd about themselves. Because when you speak, it's really about the people that you're speaking with, not about yourself. So it's really about them, and that each one of them is an influencer, and I want them really to think about it. And then mostly importantly, it's a big thank you to the pioneers, the people, you know, we stood on their shoulders, and Susan B. Anthony is the one, and we're going to celebrate like crazy her birthday and honor her and all that she went through, because I cannot imagine what she went through, and Katie B. Stanton and Alice Paul and all the different women that tried to change the landscape of this country and to get the vote, you know, 1848 to 1920. All those things I just really appreciate, and I think we need to take a breath, reflect, and thank Susan B. Anthony and others that day. So I know it's a privilege to be there, and I look forward to it, and I look forward to seeing you, Deborah. And let's have a great day.
And we look forward to seeing you, Billie Jean.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to go see the museum.
Yeah, can't wait.
I'm going to see that before the speech, Evan. So I really look forward to that. I love history, so it's going to be hallowed ground.
Well, it's our honor to have you. The tickets are still available, SusanBAnthonyHouse.org, to see Billie Jean King at the annual Susan B. Anthony Birthday Luncheon, Wednesday, February 10th, starting at noon. She's an equal rights champion, a humanitarian, and a tennis icon. Billie Jean, thanks for the time, and we'll see
you
soon in Rochester.
Thank you for having me on Connections. I love the word connection, so when I heard Connections, I was like, yes! Anyway, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
We'll see you soon. That's Billie Jean King. Let's get a short break, and Deb Hughes, the president and CEO of the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House, is with me. We'll reflect on what we just heard from equal rights champion Billie Jean King. And we'll talk about some of the issues that are important in this community and this country this year, presidential election year. More on that next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections. Are you enjoying the low gas prices? If you adjust for inflation, they're some of the lowest gas prices ever. But a local economist says that's not necessarily a good thing for a lot of reasons. We're going to talk in the first hour about a carbon tax. How much should we be paying, and what would the impact be? Then second hour, RIT has some innovative ideas for helping people going through chemotherapy. Talk with you Friday.
WXXI's fundraising campaign is underway, but let's call this the quiet phase. All you'll hear this week are 30-second appeals, like this one. But on Groundhog Day, it's back to the usual pledge drive routine, with ringing phones and tote bag offers. Lots of your friends and neighbors would rather avoid that, so they've already donated, and we're making great progress toward the goal. When we reach it, we're done. Join them. Make your pledge at WXXI.org, and thanks.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Deborah Hughes is the president and CEO of the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. I know you're excited to have Billie Jean King, even more so after that part of the conversation there.
Yeah, I was moved to tears several times when she was telling her stories.
You know, she said that it's men who get more emotional on average than even women when they meet her because they think about their daughters and the impact of what happened in 1973 and her work. I guess that kind of surprised me, but then as a parent, I think maybe not. I get it. I mean, I think about the president and what he told her, and I guess... Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm not surprised by that.
Yeah, Susan B. Anthony's father was one of the reasons she was able to do what she did. You know, when she wanted to learn long division and the teacher said, no, girls can't learn that, you know, he brought in another teacher. I think the power of a parent to recognize the gifts in their own child can be a changing force.
How much did Susan B. Anthony write about her father?
She wrote to her father. He was a very important part of her life.
Yeah.
He died before they had moved to the house on Madison Street, but there was all kinds of credit. You know, Daniel was an amazing moving force, and her whole family was very important to her.
This is now 150 years, 150th anniversary of
when...
We're
so excited about that.
Lucy Anthony, is that right?
Lucy Reed Anthony, Susan B. Anthony's mother, who was widowed, bought the house in 1866. So we've just started the 150th year of the Anthonys being there on Madison Street.
That's pretty remarkable.
I know. Susan B. Anthony... At one point, when Mary was doing some redecorating in the late 19th century, commented that, you know, this old house. It's like, well, that was more than 100 years ago.
This old house.
This old house.
150 years since the purchase, right?
Since the purchase, correct.
Since the purchase. At 17 Madison.
Yes, it was 7 Madison Street when they first bought it, but then the city renumbered the houses.
All right, very good. So talking to Deb Hughes, and so for you, you were saying that whoever wins the presidential election, you'll be happy with both parties, all the candidates roughly equal with women's rights, right?
Yeah, we didn't have that conversation.
Look, I'm not going to tee this up for the rest of the hour on politics. You know, wouldn't be fair. I only have one guest here. We try to keep it as balanced as we can. But clearly, Billie Jean King feels that this is a very, very important year. She said she spent some time in New Hampshire and Iowa, obviously campaigning for Hillary Clinton. And she talked about pay equality. She thinks that the candidate she's supporting is very, very genuine about these issues. Do you see it that way as well, Deb? I'll start there.
I would go where Billie Jean King started with her comments. I don't see this election as a women's rights election. I think that what Susan B. Anthony thought was important, democracy's on the line. The whole question about who do we empower to vote, who feels like they're participating in our society, what do we see our society's future? Who are we going to benefit? What are we, a nation of many states that come together for some common purposes around human dignity and human rights and freedom and pursuit of happiness? Or are we a lot of separate dominions that want to segregate ourselves into different societies with different values and sometimes competitive? To me, the heart of who we want to be as a democracy is what's on the line. And that's really what Susan B. Anthony was passionate about.
Are there parts of what you're seeing in this election season that make you nervous or a little fearful at times?
There are. I think the one, I'm a little bit fearful the way we now spend so much of our time. We don't have a myth around our culture right now. We're kind of fragmented in where we get our news and information. So we're not even able to predict how people are going to vote because we don't realize, you know, if you go too far off of the thruway in New York State, you can't get high-speed internet. So some of the media sources that I enjoy and have access to, other people who are on dial-up networking, all they're hearing is talk radio. And Evan, they don't hear enough of you. They hear a lot of other people who we could name. And that scares me because if their source of information, if their reality is coming from someplace that's really skewed, and I think we have that around a lot of the country, that concerns me.
So what are the issues that stand out? If this is not necessarily a women's rights election, you know, Billie Jean talked about pay equality. Let's start there. She had some very interesting things to say about pay equality, not the least of which is because her career has been built so much on this issue. You know, 1973, I'm going to confess something. Total ignorance on this subject. I came into work this morning thinking, hey, I want to pull together a few more notes here. I bet the women are still getting paid less in tennis than the men are in Grand Slam singles titles, for example, even though women's ratings can be better than men. You know, and of course, I find out I'm way wrong on that. And I didn't even know the story of Billie Jean King telling the U.S. Open, you're not getting me until you pay the women the same as the men. I didn't know it took 28 more years before the Australian Open followed suit and that Wimbledon came around in 2007. So those things I wasn't even aware of. So in some ways, I look at that and say, wow, you know, those things have been happening for years. And yet we still see pay gaps for women of color that Billie Jean talked about. You know, what's the biggest concern for you when it comes to the pay gap?
Well, locally, we've been talking a lot about the minimum wage and about poverty in Rochester. And I was a young teenager when Billie Jean King was taking on Bobby Riggs. And we still had a value in our culture about the living wage. And one of the reasons that you paid men more was the assumption, oh, well, he has a family, he has children, you have to pay him. Not necessarily what he was worth, but the minimum that would be needed to sustain a family. Well, we haven't applied that to women. We have so many women who are heads of households, and the question isn't, gee, should we pay a living wage to that person? Should we think about whether or not that person has enough not only for them to live on, but also for their family to be supported? I wish that was a value that we were looking at. You know, I know nonprofits are having a whole discussion about the minimum wage and the living wage, and I honestly think that our nonprofits in our community should absolutely be challenged to go to the $15 an hour as the minimum, because we know that $30,000 to $35,000 is a minimum wage in our community. And are we feeding the bottom by taking these incredibly dedicated people who get underpaid. So to me, we should start with a conversation about that. What's a fair wage, and what do we need to do to drive that?
Billie Jean King made a moral case for eliminating the gap between men and women who are working the same job. And that was a very interesting set of comments she made, because I began by asking her to respond to a very common comment I get from some listeners, which is that, of course, men get paid more. They negotiate harder. They ask for more. They push for raises. They push for promotions. Now, we're going to set aside the fact that there's a lot of research that shows that if women do that as hard, they can be penalized. They have to tread a little bit more carefully in negotiations. But let's assume that all things being equal, let's just give that comment credence that, okay, men negotiate harder. And Billie Jean said, yeah, that's in many ways, that's true. Men do tend to push harder for raises, push harder for promotions, and they're more likely to get it. So she's saying part of the solution is she talks to women, she works with women. You know, this is how the business world works. You may have to do this. But she also says the message for the CEOs is this: you should not feel good if you've got two employees doing the same job and you get to pay one less because they didn't push as hard for a raise. And because more often than not, it's the woman who didn't push as hard, and look what you've done to that family. That may be a single mom. It may be a married woman. It may not be. Whatever the case may be, but the moral case is you're hurting other people. You're not just hurting one person. You're hurting families. You're hurting society. We have to make up for it in other ways. I thought that was a very interesting framing of it. What did you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's an interesting piece. I think that I hold a bias because my experience has been that women are more loyal. So as an employer, if I had a male employee who I thought was really exceptional, and they said, I'm going to leave if you don't give me a raise, I have never had a female employee say that to me.
You've had male employees?
I have had male employees say that. And I think that that's a problem. I mean, it's wonderful that you've got wonderfully loyal employees. So that's a question that every employer should have in their mind. Am I really being conscientious about that? Am I really thinking about the value? I think in most employment situations, I would hope you don't see the difference where you really do have two people doing the same job that are getting paid differently. I think we have structures and we're doing better at that. I think that we still have places where we segregate the job and we value it differently. And that doesn't make any sense to me. There's a lot of places now, especially with technology, where people who in the corporate rank are lower, who should be paid a lot more because they're critical to the success of the organization.
Sure. And I will only say to that, Deb, I can think of, and maybe it's just because of the nature of the jobs that I've worked, you know, in television newsrooms, every job I've been hired, you come in the door and you can choose to take the first offer you get, or you can negotiate for more. I'm probably a little different than, I mean, I guess if I'm accepting this paradigm that men tend to push harder for raises and promotions, maybe I'm a little different. I've pushed a little less hard coming in the door at most places. I've always thought, you know what, I can come in and I can prove myself and then I can come back and ask for more later. But I also don't want to create, I don't want to draw blood from a stone and get every last dime. I'd rather get paid what I think I'm worth and develop a good relationship and work as a team player, as opposed to kind of knocking every door down and having a fist fight over money. So I've been a little bit different, but I can tell you that every reporter I've, to the extent that I've known salaries, is all making something slightly different based on what they negotiated. And so I'm sure that does happen. I'm sure it does happen. And we've heard some CEOs in the last year or two say, we should just stop negotiating. We should say, this job gets paid this. I don't care who you are. This job gets paid this. I don't care who you are. And, you know, I wonder if we'll go more in that direction eventually. What would you think of that direction?
Yeah, I would be very fine with that direction. I think as long as it's at least a living wage, I think I would look more for the changes that have happened at the top. Whenever I hear of someone who's been at a company for 3 or 4 years, they're making an incredible salary that's many, many multiples higher than even the middle managers in that same company, and they're getting a severance package, I can't help but in my mind divide that by $50,000 and figure out how many people could have had a great job had that person not taken that huge severance package. And we aren't addressing that issue. And I don't, you know, if you've got a company, the company can make that decision, the board can make that decision. But to me, if I were on the board of the company or if I had a privately owned company, I would see my way of making history to have as many people who could benefit from participating in the wealth and success of that company as anywhere.
My guest for the rest of the hour is Deb Hughes, the president and CEO of the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. Earlier this hour, we had a chance to speak by phone with Billie Jean King, a tennis icon and a humanitarian, an equal rights champion. And she is going to be here on Wednesday, February 10th for the annual Susan B. Anthony Birthday Luncheon. It's at the Rochester Riverside Convention Center from noon to 1:30. And tickets are still available if you go to SusanBAnthonyHouse.org. I want to ask you, you mentioned, you know, being a young woman when the Riggs match happened in 1973. Did you watch it? Do you remember?
Was it was huge. Yeah. I have three older sisters, and my dad was very much encouraging us to watch it. I was raised to think we could do anything that we wanted to do. But I also was raised pre-Title IX. So in my school, the girls' programs were often intramurals. The boys got sports. We actually, at one point, I was playing on the volleyball team, and we were supposed to get out early so that we could go to a tournament and have a meal. And parents had made the meal. And just before it was time for us to get released early from class, the vice principal came in and said, no, girl sports don't get released early from class. You belong in school. And the end result of that story is that to this day, I can't eat tuna casserole because the tuna casserole that was in the locker room was waiting for us 2 hours later when we got released. And almost all of us didn't make it through the tournament. Because tuna casserole shouldn't sit in the locker room for 2 hours before you eat it and play volleyball. But that was the norm. Girls, you know, yeah, we could kind of play at sports. We weren't worthy of. It wasn't taken seriously. And then here comes Billie Jean King. I had forgotten how people didn't think she could beat him. I mean, it was kind of, and it wasn't because was he better or she better. It was because she's, you know, she's female. So it just can't even happen. And that's in my lifetime. That's not that long ago. Now I love when we have young women of distinction or interns at the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House, almost every girl who has excelled and is a part of that recognition has played a sport or two or three and has learned some of the skills Billie Jean King referenced. You know, these women that come and do summer internships with us, they're sharp and they're together and they can negotiate and I love seeing that they have choices and can do things that they're good at.
So on February 10th, you've got Billie Jean coming. She talked a little bit about what she's going to be talking about. Give me the theme for the event and what's coming up that
day. I loved what she was saying. Our theme for this year is making history. And, you know, that's the past and the present and the future. Thinking about Susan B. Anthony, when you come for a tour, we want you to hear what Susan B., how the world was different when Susan B. Anthony ended her life, and how she still wants the world to be different in the future. And Billie Jean King, I think we think about her making history with Bobby Riggs, and she's still making history with her work for human rights.
So if you get a ticket that day and you haven't been down to the luncheon before, you get a chance to hear Billie Jean King here. She's probably going to touch on some of the themes she talked about today, pay equity, some of the things that she is really, really passionate about today. But do you get people who come down? I mean, in the past, you've had Cokie Roberts and Helen Thomas, Arianna Huffington, a lot of great names here. You guys always bring in great names here.
Thank you.
Do you start building, you know, a network? You know, what's the value of the relationships you start creating?
Well, there's a huge connection. One, just because it gives us national visibility and it connects people with the house and the place, and it makes that story of Susan B. Anthony real. Her name is shared all over the place, but we actually have the place here in Rochester. It grounds her. It's usually inspiring for our speakers, so that's what we want to be about as the museum. The unique thing about Billie Jean King is I have never had so many people contact me who have said, you know, can you get her to sign this? Can I shake her hand? My life was changed by her. The world is so different. It's almost, you know, where people want to give me a bribe. Can you get me access? And what I've had to say is I think we all have to just be thrilled to be in the room with her because I have never had so many people express that she made a profound difference in their lives.
So is it lip service then, or are tickets really still available?
Tickets are really still available. We had a cap, but we wanted to keep it open till after we had a conversation and make it possible for people to buy tickets.
There's a lot of things that kind of line up with, you know, anniversaries. We just passed the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and there's a lot of different things we could round out the hour with. There's a new film, Suffragette, things like that that are in the public consciousness. Let me just ask you, you know, what are the landmark, you know, that kind of come to mind for you now? Voting Rights Act, What's the impact, you know, for example?
The Voting Rights Act is huge. People forget in this country that ever since the beginning of this country, states have had the ability to determine who could vote, that was not a federal guarantee. When Susan B. Anthony got arrested in 1872, they were trying to demonstrate that if you're a citizen, you had a right to vote. And the Supreme Court concluded, no, you don't. That's something that the state set that gate. And it wasn't until we had the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that we asserted on a federal level that people could vote in this country and shouldn't be denied the right to vote. We still do it, you know, if you're a felon, if you, based on your age. One of the things that's fascinating to me is I know people who don't vote, and they say it doesn't make a difference. But boy, if it didn't make a difference, people wouldn't be working so hard to prevent people from getting to the ballot box. It's a really powerful tool. It's the basis of what makes us different from almost every other nation in the world. And to me, it's really exciting to think about some of the conversations we're having right now around the election, about things that are at stake. And the most important thing is, what can we do to get people out to vote?
We had a conversation on Monday on this program with a couple of Hillary Clinton supporters and a couple of delegates for Bernie Sanders. And one of the delegates for Bernie Sanders, Mary Lupien, she said she doesn't know if Clinton is the nominee, if she can vote for her. She's a little concerned. She's too much of the political machine. And one of the guests, and I brought up the idea that if you don't vote and, you know, you're not sort of participating, you're ceding the election to your fellow citizens. And no matter what happens in the primaries, I think the national election matters because of the Supreme Court over the next 4 years. When you think about the impact of the justices, who will probably be, I don't know what's going to happen between now and the time Mr. Obama is out of the White House, but there could be one, there could be four appointments or somewhere in between. What do you think, Deb Hughes, the impact could be on the Supreme Court level when it comes to future legislation, whether it's about voting rights, whether it's about, you know, sort of related issues?
Yeah, the Susan B. Anthony List, which is the political action group that's kind of our nemesis.
Susan B. Anthony List.
Yes.
Not related to you. Not
at all related.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Yeah.
But we always get a lot of flack in election years because they've got a lot of money and they're a political action group. The pledge that they want politicians to sign has as one of its four planks that you'll support no Supreme Court justice who is not pro-life. I would support Supreme Justices who understand the law and can make excellent decisions. I want someone who's got situational ethics, where they can listen to the particular case, apply case law, apply what we have, and make a decision. I don't want to send anybody into a position as a justice who has pre-decided what the case is going to be. I'm entitled to a jury of my peers. I'm entitled to a court of law and a chance to build an argument and be heard. And to me, yes, there's a tremendous amount at stake. The Congress for the last 8 years has been totally blocking federal court appointments. We don't have enough federal judges on the bench because people have been not wanting to get someone who politically disagree with them. I don't think party politics belongs in a court of law.
Andrew writes to us sort of along those lines. We hear a lot of political candidates, particularly presidential candidates, who will cite Susan B. Anthony in various ways to support their own positions. And I'm curious to know what your guest thinks about hearing her name come up on the campaign trail so often, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican.
I love Susan B. Anthony's name coming up on the campaign trail. She was the person who said it's always great to get press, get good press if you can, but whatever you can get. Then I would like people to actually find out what she said. Sometimes I've made comparisons because of my background that I hear a lot of people quote the Bible too, but they haven't actually read it.
So you find a lot, not all the time, but sometimes when people quote Susan B. Anthony, they're getting something wrong.
Yeah, there's a wonderful article that's going to be published by a local man, Bill Fugate, soon, around one of the most common misquotes of Susan B. Anthony, which the Susan B. Anthony List uses as a bumper sticker, and it's, "I abhor the crime of child murder." And they use that to talk about Susan B. Anthony around reproductive freedom or reproductive justice. That's a quote from an article that was printed in Susan B. Anthony's Revolution magazine in the 1860s. And the article is signed initial A. And Bill's done a great job of analyzing how often there were articles printed in the Revolution magazine by other people or responses to other people. Susan B. Anthony wouldn't have signed it A. And the other piece is, if you actually read that editorial, it's opposed to the criminalization of abortion. So it gets completely taken out of context. It gets attributed to Susan B. Anthony. And that's not how we like to approach history.
Okay, so first of all, if you see the quote on a bumper sticker, I abhor
the crime of child murder,
Susan B. Anthony, you're saying that is not historically accurate. She didn't say it. Didn't write it.
That's correct.
Do we know where she was on that issue very specifically?
So the reason that there was a discussion in the Revolution magazine was abortion was legal in Susan B. Anthony's time. So the editorial speaks against the criminalization of abortion. She never made a public stance, but it was legal. She was made very clear public stance. She was absolutely for sex education for children and adults. She was absolutely for birth control and that people should have the right and freedom to plan the timing and the number of their pregnancies. And she also believed that women should make decisions about their own bodies and their own lives. But no, we don't have anything in writing about her addressing an issue at that point in time.
Do people ask you, would she vote for Hillary Clinton? I mean, who knows?
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I say who knows. I don't know where you stand on what you think Susan B. Anthony would do or if you even want to share that. My guess is Susan B. Anthony would be thrilled to see women in leadership roles, but I don't know if that would be enough for her to decide I'm going to vote for this person or not.
So she said that she didn't want to be aligned with any party. That as soon as you aligned yourself to a party on one issue, you were bound to them on other issues. And so she really felt we should make decisions about issues based on those particular issues.
She was so wise.
She was, at least near the end. You know, fortunately, we get her whole lifetime of 86 years and we can pick the wisest things she said and did.
You mean she wasn't perfect?
No, she actually was not.
How about that? She was human. Susan B. Anthony. Deb Hughes, the president and CEO of the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. And the Susan B. Anthony Birthday Luncheon is coming up on Wednesday, February 10th at noon at the Rochester Riverside Convention Center. Their guest this year is Billie Jean King, the tennis icon, the winner of that 1973 Battle of the Sexes, among so many other titles, and an equal rights champion. And she'll be there. You can get tickets now, SusanBAnthonyHouse.org. I know you're going to have a great event. Thanks for sharing that conversation with us today and for inviting Billie Jean to come on the program today. It's great to see you.
Thank you so much, Evan.
All right, and thanks for listening to the program today. Thanks to Valerie LaBanca, the engineer of the broadcast. Megan Mack is the producer. Marielle Brinkerhoff and Kate Cowie-Haskell are interns. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Member Supported Public Radio.